This is Dr. J with Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your radio tuned to the left and your mind in the open position as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future. Talking with Jody Dean, author of 1998 Aliens in America, Conspiracy Cultures from Outer Space to Cyberspace. Jody Dean teaches political, feminist, and culture theory at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in New York. She received her PhD from Columbia in 1992. She's the author of Solidarity of Strangers, Feminism After Identity Politics, edited a volume on feminism and democracy. Her current projects address conspiracy culture and cultural studies, and she's editing a collection, Political Theory, The Cultural Turn, which will be coming out from Cornell Press, and another book, Three Fables of Conspiracy. Welcome, Jody Dean.
Hi, thanks.
Your book, Aliens in America, has made quite a splash, and we're going to be going through the different points that you make there, but the book addresses centrally the subculture of abductees and ufology in the country. How prevalent and is this subculture, and is it growing?
It's a unbelievably prevalent culture subculture. What I'd like to mention, actually, are some quick UFO facts that I got from Phil Cozzano's book, UFOs, A Manual for the Millennium, just to give you a sense of how prevalent it is. As Cozzano points out, for every fundamentalist Christian in the United States, there are five UFO believers. UFO believers outnumber Roman Catholics by more than 2-1, and UFO believers outnumber the voters who placed Reagan, Bush, and Clinton in office. So although people might think of it as a subculture, oddly, it's almost a mainstream or mass culture because the numbers are so strong.
Do you think it's having an impact outside? I mean, obviously, evangelical Christians organized in the various political manifestations have had a tremendous impact on American culture. Are abductees or the UFO, the people who believe in UFOs, are they having an impact on American culture?
I think they have an impact, but I think it's a different one. You can't talk about it in the same kind of specific political terms as we're used to talking about the religious right. One way to think about the impact is the way that advertisers now use UFO and alien alien imagery almost all the time, like the new Volkswagen ads, say back engineered from UFO technology. Part of the impact that UFO and alien abduction believers are having is one at the level of consumer culture, of mediatized culture. They're affecting our everyday belief systems more than our actual political choices.
Now, one of the points that you make, one of the points that is controversial about your book is that you're a bit of an epistemological agnostic about
right.
the whole question.
Right.
And people have been, some have been critical of that. Do you think that this is, obviously you've answered this question many times, but why have you not taken an explicit position in the book about whether you give credence to the subculture's truth claims?
That's a good question. I don't take an explicit position because I feel that people who ask that question first are using it so they know exactly where to place me. They want to pin me down. So if I say, yes, I believe in alien abduction, then what they can do is write me off as a wacko. If I say, no, I don't believe, then they treat me as just any other skeptic and don't think that I have anything new to say. So what I want to do is shift the conversation away from the epistemology and toward meaning. What does all of this mean? Not exactly what is it as a fact.
But isn't the meaning rather centrally inflected by whether these people are sufferers from a certain kind of neurosis or whether they are actually suffering from actual persecution and exploitation by aliens?
Well, that's a really good question, and I tell you honestly, I grapple with it all the time. But one of the ways I think about it is like this. Religion is a powerful force in our lives, regardless of whether or not there is a God or whether or not they're angels. If those people are deluded or if those people are firmly, accessing the truth, we can't know that. But what we can do is look at the way that their religious beliefs tell us something about their lives.
Mm. Now, the other kind of epistemological question that's raised by your work is the epistemological populism you point out about the public's apprehension of these views. In other words, that the talk show epistemology is whatever works for you.
Right.
And you think that this is becoming a more prevalent approach to the proliferation of truth claims.
Yeah, absolutely. I gave a talk a few weeks ago at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and it was really interesting to me because there were a bunch of different kinds of people there, and folks were shocked to hear that academic political philosophers believed that the public sphere was based on truth and reason. They were like, who would think that, right? Don't you watch TV? And so I think of my book as in a way, more like trying to tell academics, everyday people think what you're doing is bananas, and also telling everyday people, look, you guys have a real insight into how democracy is working that the academy needs to be able to think about.
So when you say that what academics are doing is that academics are kind of stuck in a certain model that they've been socialized into about the way the world works, and the public is much more skeptical about all those models.
Absolutely. And the thing is, as you know from the book, it's I also think it's difficult to talk about something like the public, mm-hmm. right? I think that there's lots and lots of conversations going on, as we know from any time we access a website, any kind of website, or look at different channels on cable TV. I mean, there are lots and lots of different conversations. So there are lots and lots of things that claim to be public, but half of the people or a bunch of people won't even know that conversation is going on. So I think that we need to start, especially as we go into a new millennium, thinking as politicians, as activists, as theorists, as academics, as ordinary citizens, in terms of multiple different kinds of conversations, rather than saying this one is central or this is the one everybody is involved in.
Now, the connection you make to the net is that the net is a kind of concrete example of the proliferation of information sources, and that for every, we see this in medicine and in the field of bioethics, that
right.
For every website that you can find that's AMA-sponsored that bashes alternative medicine, you can find a dozen apparently legitimate studies on the web validating St. John's Wort or whatever, and people don't know what to believe anymore, and it basically comes down to a political decision on their part.
Exactly. What I've been it's been astounding to me, the more that I've been talking about this basic theme of mine from the book, is uncovering different sources. Let me say this differently. Ever since I started working on the book, I've become more attuned to the diversity of views inside science that don't appear in mainstream media. And one key example is debates around salt. This came, I mean, salt, you know, the stuff that we put on our food. Scientific American recently showed a debate where there are major government fundings of different studies around whether or not salt is good or bad for you. And there's
for
not
high
a
blood
consensus.
Pressure.
Yeah, for high blood pressure.
Right.
And there's not a consensus, even though it's been so-called common knowledge that we're supposed to cut down on salt.
Right, exactly. Now, some of the folks that you talk about in your book, the history of the popular history of abductions, Betty and Barney Hill figure very prominently. And what are some of the peculiarities of their case?
Yeah, well, the key thing around their case, or at least what I think helped made it come into mass media, is that it's an interracial couple in the middle of the 1960s. I mean, we have to keep in mind when we start thinking about UFOs that Americans have long believed in all sorts of strange things. In Western history, in European history, there's beliefs in elves and all sorts of stuff like that. So just believing in aliens isn't enough to capture popular imagination. What made this particular case of this particular UFO case come to the fore is that this is an interracial couple who seems very, very reasonable, but obviously under a lot of stress. And what they do is, what happens is they have a weird sighting and just a strange experience that they can't understand while driving through the mountains of New Hampshire in the early 60s. And then later on...
They've lost time.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, they don't know they've had lost time for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of interesting. They just feel ill at ease. But over the next week or so, as Betty Hill's having nightmares, they remember that they have seen a sighting, and they contact a local group. They contact a military person, I think, Transatlantic UFO Group. And at that point, they retrace their steps and figure out that there's missing time. So they don't say that they had missing time at the very beginning. They remember it later, right, that somehow their time is missing. And then a few years after that, Barney Hill undergoes hypnosis and remembers being taken on a ship, and then so does Betty Hill, and then describes a probe going into her navel that she later thinks is a pregnancy test.
Now, the role of hypnosis and the kind of reconstruction of repressed memory becomes central, and the next major landmark would be Whitley Strieber, perhaps.
There are a couple of things like the Pascagoula case and then the Travis Walton case, but I think that those are probably only really well known to folks in the UFO community, although they made mainstream papers and magazines. Mm-hmm. What was the huge big deal as a New York Times bestseller is exactly, as you say, Whitley Strieber and Communion.
Mm-hmm. And which went to the top of the New York Times bestseller list as nonfiction in 1988. Then after that, we have the growth of academic ufology with John Mack and a number of psychologists and the kind of repressed memory crowd, right?
Right. It's been interesting to me the more I've learned about the serious research inside the UFO community on alien abduction. It's been interesting for me to find out how little warrant they give the repressed memory syndrome who talk about satanic child abuse. I mean, the abduction researchers think that the repressed memories of child abuse and wild daycare, you know, satanic stories is bananas. I mean, they find that outrageous and can't believe that anybody would give credence to those stories.
And vice versa. Right. Now, explain the case of John Mack, because he is pretty central now, isn't he?
Yeah. John, I personally, I have to say it's because of John Mack that I started looking at this. John Mack is a Harvard professor who came out with a book in 1994 called Abduction, and he believes that the abductees are describing a phenomenologically real phenomenon. He won't say for sure that he believes it's extraterrestrials, right? I mean, he entertains various possibilities of cosmic consciousness or, say, interdimensional folks. I mean, he doesn't stress somebody's, you know, folks from other planets, but he very much believes that the abductees are telling a true story, as in they're physically taken away, they are being subjected to various kinds of experiments. Of course, Harvard was not excited that one of their own was taking alien abduction seriously, and they tried to revoke his tenure, and he fought for a while and, you know, to great personal, financial cost to keep his tenure during all of this. But he's seriously engaged in trying to get to the truth of the matter of alien abduction.
One of the fascinating aspects of your story is your chapter on the role of NASA in all of this. And again, you're not making an explicit causal case because of your epistemological position.
Right.
But you do draw out some fascinating parallels between the NASA media campaigns and the whole role of NASA in public culture in the 60s and 70s, and the parallel things that were happening in the abductee subculture.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad you mentioned this. In the New York Review of Books, Frederick Cruz accuses me of being anti-NASA or, you know, vehemently against the space program, and that's just bananas. And what I do in my analysis of the space program is look at the way watching television became a civic duty. I mean, the space program was produced in order to tell folks, look, Americans can achieve something. It was part of a space race in the context of the Cold War against the Soviets. And we had to show that American technological achievements were better than anything that the communists were doing. To prove that, folks had to see it. They had to watch it. And that's the same thing that happens with abduction. Folks see it on television. They're part of a public debate. Like the space program that people had to watch, so abductees appeared on television. They were testifying to their achievements in a way, or if not achievements, not quite the right term, it's more to what has happened to them, in the same way that seeing astronauts on television testified to what was happening to America.
One of the parallels that you draw is that the descriptions about the astronaut training program. And if you watch the movie The Right Stuff, which I did recently, it's all about the rigorous physical tests that the astronauts were put through to make sure that they were the best and the brightest and most physically fit. But they were put in through tremendous physical stressors, and some of those physical stressors were precisely parallel to what abductees were describing.
Yeah, I actually think it was kind of funny the more I read The Right Stuff and thought about the way that they were doing rectal probes or sperm counts. I mean, you really don't think of that as something necessary for astronauts.
You had to be a virile man in space.
Absolutely. And it's that kind of turning astronauts into test subjects that links up with how the abductees experience outer space. They're test subjects, too. So it reminds us that there's always been this other side to the astronaut. The astronaut's not always just a hero. He has been a test subject, and abductees have been test subjects as well.
Well, in The Right Stuff, Tom Wolfe wrote that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tom Wolfe describes some of the astronauts talking about not wanting to be monkeys in tin cans.
That right.
They felt like they were, in fact, incredibly vulnerable, just being thrown up in a desperate effort at national prestige. You also talk about the way that the media has shaped other media other than the NASA campaign, the popular perception of aliens. And I recently had the opportunity to read Aliens versus Hollywood. I don't know if you've seen this text. It's
It's huge. It's a completely long book, right?
Yeah, 600-page history of every single monster or alien that's ever appeared in film or television since the beginning. One of the things that he points out, and which I found very curious, was that there was a political cycle to the depiction of aliens in the popular media. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to notice such a thing or if other people have mentioned it.
In light of what the government's so-called use or the alleged government use of science fiction, I'm familiar with the book, but I haven't looked at it in detail.
Mm-hmm.
But abductees think this too. A number of abductees and folks within the UFO community think that the government is giving us messages through media. Now, that makes sense once we think about the space program, where the government's definitely given us messages through media. What they do is take seriously things like ET or Close Encounters and think that the government's giving us a message about those. I mean, through those. They think that ET is a message that we're supposed to love the aliens or have a good relationship with the aliens. And then movies like ID4 are telling us that, no, there's been a problem and we're at war with the aliens.
Mm-hmm. So it's secret communications to be decoded by the insiders.
Exactly.
And my final question was whether you thought that there was any political significance or kind of cultural significance to the different aliens that the abductee subculture believe exist out there. In other words, there's the Greys, and then there's other species of aliens. Do you think that these have kind of resonance with different cultural archetypes?
That's a really good question. I've thought about it a lot of different, I thought about it in different ways. One thing I can say for sure is that different countries have had different relations to the various types of aliens. For example, in Britain, folks are more likely to report the Nordics or the tall blonde type of aliens.
Mm.
In South and Central America, they're more likely to report the reptilian kinds of aliens. I actually don't think, though, that we can, to give a one-to-one, oh, this means that race or this means this other race. I don't think it's that literal. I think what it does show is that, folks think that aliens are diverse.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really want to encourage people to take a look at your book. Your website's also fascinating, www.aliensinamericaoneword.com. And there'll be additional links from the Event Horizon website, www.changesurfer.com/Event Horizon/. And can they email you, Jody?
Yeah, please do it. jdean@hws.edu.
Keep up the great work.
Oh, thanks. And thanks for giving me an opportunity to talk about it.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, @changesurfer.com.
Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.